Okay, it's time to commit. 2024 is the year for prioritizing yourself. Begin your new smile journey with Byte, and you could start seeing results in just 2 to 3 weeks. Just order your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95 at Byte.com. Byte Clear Aligners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces. Plus, they offer financing options, accept eligible insurance, and you can pay with your HSA, FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
That's not just the sound of that first sip of Morning Joe. It's the sound of someone shopping for a car on Carvana from the comfort of home.
That's a good blend.
It's time to take it easy, like answering some easy questions to get pre-qualified for a car in minutes.
Talk about starting the morning right.
Just like customizing your terms so your car fits your budget.
Mm-mm-mm.
Visit Carvana.com or download the app to experience car shopping the way it should be. Convenient, comfortable. Ah.
Hey, Sound Opinions listeners. If you support us on Patreon, you get to listen to our podcast ad-free on Patreon. Listening to Sound Opinions, and this week we're talking to Fairport Convention member and solo artist Richard Thompson about his career and memoir. I'm Greg Kot.
And I'm Jim DeRogatis. But first, we review some new music from Chicago punk rock legends Naked Raygun and an album from Americana artist Amethyst Kia. Greg, that guitar, that bass, those drums, Jeff Pizzotti, Naked Raygun, a new song called Broken Things from their first album in 3 decades, Over the Overlords. Naked Raygun is a band that has meant an awful lot to the two of us since its heyday in the mid-80s. 5 incredibly strong albums between 1985 and 1990, Throb Throb to Raygun, Naked Raygun. And then the band, I guess we used to say broke up, but now we should say they went on hiatus. Yeah. A very long hiatus. They came back for 2 reunion shows in 1997. 2006, they came back for another and said, we are back for good. But they have been very low-key. Aside from occasional performances, including the biggest of their career, when Dave Grohl of the Foo Fighters, a huge fan, had them open Wrigley Field, they've apparently been making this album for about a decade. Their longtime bassist, Pierre Kesdi, died of cancer in October 2020, but he is on this new album. The album was finished, and now the album is here, released with an incredible amount of no hype. None. Mm-hmm. I keep getting emails from friends saying, there's a new Naked Raygun album? It is one of the longtime lineups. 3 of the members are from those golden years. Jeff Pizzotti on vocals, Eric Spicer on drums. Pierre Kesdi, as I said, played bass on this album. And Bill Stevens, you know, he's still the new guy, only been around since 1990 with that last album of the first run. What are they giving us? Let's play a song from Over the Overlords, and we'll give our reviews. This is Living in the Good Times by Naked Raygun.
Well, why you can't against the undertone?
That is Living in the Good Times from Naked Ray Gun. Over the Overlords is the name of the record, as Jim pointed out. What else to say about them other than that they were one of the most influential bands of the 80s? Certainly hugely influential band locally, hugely influential band on a national scale. You can draw a straight line from them to Nirvana and the whole alternative rock explosion of the early 90s.
Except they were never making any money.
They didn't make that much. No, they didn't. But they have persevered. A lot of health issues in the band. Here they are making a new record, Living in the Good Times. The only thing that it lacked was a whoa 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 kind of harmony vocal in it, but otherwise it is a classic
Naked Ray Gun
punk pop anthem. Broken Things Too is another song very much in the vein of 80s Naked Ray Gun. I was going to say Living in the Good Times, same thing. And if they had given us an entire album of just those kind of songs, it would have been great. I mean, it would have been like there was nothing wrong with those 80s albums. Those albums still hold up over time. Punchy, melodic, hard-hitting songs with something to say. Pizzotti remains a social political philosopher from a blue-collar perspective.
Yeah,
he's always talking about stuff that is not, you know, conventional love songs in any sense.
Installs air conditioning equipment for industry, you know. I mean, these were blue-collar Chicago guys.
And Pizzotti's also got a great singing voice. I compare him to somebody like Robin Zander of Cheap Trick. The guy seems almost ageless in the way he sounds like Jeff Pizzotti. He's still got a very strong, potent voice. But what I like about this record is they could have made just another album of anthems just like they did it back in the 80s, and they made another album of anthems, but they're playing around with the template now.
Mm-hmm.
You're starting to hear things like that Middle Eastern tonality that they bring to Suicide Bomb, you know, that choir effect.
I will not be your Suicide Bomb. I will not be your Suicide Bomb.
Black and Gray. Where are these orchestral arrangements coming from? A little bit of a metal chug in that song.
What about the tribute to Pierre, Soul Hole Baby?
Yeah.
I mean, there's a little bass solo, and man, was great.
And then it cranks out into that sort of chaotic finish. It's like a two-part song where you get the dirgy eulogy part, and then you get this kind of cathartic moment at the end. Farewell to Arms, the horns, you know, Naked Ray Gun with horns on it.
Well, Jeff always had a little mod in him. He had this side band in the 90s called The Bomb. There's a little bit of, pseudo-ska mod.
Well, Jim, I think they've sort of expanded what they do arrangement-wise without losing sight of who they are, which is a great band.
I mean, in the 80s, why was it Naked Ray Gun? We were in the middle of the Reagan era. Now they are looking out from the perspective of the Trump years without ever being preachy, while always being melodic. I will even say, I think after the Buzzcocks, who were always huge heroes to Naked Ray Gun, I don't think there's been a punk band that's ever been as more melodic. Into, I mean, just, I went to this record with trepidation, you know?
Oh, yeah.
Because I don't want to.
As you always do with decades-long, hiatus, right?
We don't want to live in the past, and we don't want them to let us down. They didn't. It's a great record, and the fact that you don't even know it's out there yet, most of you listeners, give it a spin.
That's a track called Fancy Drones, Fracture Me, from Amethyst Kia. Her first widely distributed solo record called Wary and Strange. Amethyst Kea, some of you may know that name. She was in somewhat of a bluegrass supergroup, if there can be such a thing, a few years ago with Rhiannon Giddens. The name of the group was Our Native Daughters. They got nominated for a Grammy. I first got wind of Kea's talent on that record. She had a standout song called Black Myself, which we are about to play again because it's from her new record. She kind of redoes that song.
Completely reimagined.
You know, then I did a little research on her. Her first solo record was a very alternative rock approach to music. She was playing, you know, she was an alt-rocker, for better, lack of a better term.
A Stone Temple Pilots fan, yeah. She has said.
A little bit of Radiohead in there. So this was around 2013. And then digging back into her roots, she's a gay African-American woman growing up in Tennessee with all of the biases you can imagine growing up in that environment, trying to form an identity that was not conforming to the typical template of what you should sound like, what kind of musician you should be. So now we have Wary and Strange, a record she made with Tony Berg, a producer who has worked with people like Phoebe Bridgers and Amy Mann. We're going to review it in a second, but let's play her new version of Black Myself from Amethyst Kea's Wary and Strange on Sound Opinions.
I want to jump the fence and watch my face in the creek, but I'm black myself. I want to sweep that down right off a beat, but I'm black myself. I'm tired of walking around with no shoes on, because I'm black myself. And your precious God ain't gonna bless me, because I'm black myself.
Black Myself from Wary and Strange, the new album by Amethyst Kea. Wow. I pick up the banjo and they sneer at me. She's a virtuoso banjo player. 'Cause I'm black myself. You better lock your doors when I walk by, 'cause I'm black myself. A very powerful song, Greg. You were going to highlight Amethyst Kea as a buried treasure, and we both decided, no, this deserves a full review. We both want to weigh in. We are both fans of this music. I think after the great Brittany Howard in Alabama Shakes, this is one of the most important voices and best and most passionate souls in the, for lack of a better term, Americana genre, playing American roots music, a little country, a little rock and roll, a little soul, a little gospel I hear every once in a while, and, you know, showing a really impressive range. That Ballad of Lost is exactly that, a slow and beautiful ballad. Absolutely enchanting. We have other tracks that have a significant amount of anger. Black Myself, as opposed to the earlier version she did with Giddens, is kind of reimagined as a Southern rock song.
Mm-hmm.
You know, she's not going to let those old guys with the pickup trucks and the gun racks own this genre. It's hers, too. She grew up in Tennessee. She has a lot to say and a voice that is very much worth listening to. This is one of the strongest albums I've heard this year.
Well, she's got an amazing voice, first of all, and that is at the center of this record. I also think that Tony Berg, working with him opened up her sound, allowed her to be herself. Because she's talked about this idea, like, well, I made this kind of rockish record, and then I made this very bluegrassy record, and why can't I be all of those things and more?
Yeah.
You know, why can't I put all of that together in a record? And he goes, yeah, why not? Let's do that. It took him two attempts to make this record the way she wanted to make it. The initial one was very conservative. The second swipe through the record, they started mixing up these sounds in a way that was really fascinating. Fancy Drones, Fracture Me, that, you know, what is that genre? You've got this sort of finger-picked guitar over that walloping, thick bottom that's sort of lurching along, and then you've got this sort of floating quality. Is it keyboards? I understand there's something, there's a bass harmonica in there. In fact, a lot of these songs have this sense of there's something more going on than just the voice and guitar. There's almost like this sense of ghosts floating around, these specters. Yeah. She's talking a lot about loss.
There's literal ghosts. I mean, her mother was a victim of suicide. Her father suffered from drug addiction. She's had a lot of loss in her life.
Oh, yeah. And I think she's talking about that on a lot of these songs, the whole idea of betrayal and loss and, you know, finding solace in booze, self-medicating.
Yeah.
There's a dire quality about some of the songs, about the lyrics in some of the songs, but at the same time, there's a strength in that voice. And, you know, there's a reason that she frames the record with those soapbox songs. You know,
yeah.
There's soapbox and then the soapbox repeats, where she talks about, I don't want to hear how you would do it.
Yeah,
I know how to do it. I'm going to be myself. I'm going to be allowed to be myself for maybe the first time in my life.
Don't want to hear your soapbox speech. Want to know how you would do it. Want to know how it should be. Because I don't care what you think. You can keep
I'm really glad that you did Black Myself, because that's a song that deserves a huge audience. It's one of the most powerful anthems of self-empowerment and self-realization of the last 4 or 5 years.
Great stuff, Greg. That's what we thought about the latest from Amethyst Kia and Naked Raygun, two records, Greg, that our listeners were eager for us to review. As always, we want to hear from them. Leave us a voice message on our website, soundopinions.org. Next, we've got a conversation with British folk rock legend Richard Thompson on Sound Opinions. Sound Opinions is supported by Goose Island. Since 1988, Goose Island has been brewing award-winning beers in Chicago that are inspired by this city. Take 312 Lemonade Shandy, Tropical Beer Hug Double IPA, and a rotating series of hazy IPAs only available in Chicago. You know, every time we go down to Goose Island, there's another one that they're pushing on us.
That's right.
They're all good.
Absolutely. And what supporters of musical culture, you know, in the city of Chicago and elsewhere, if you go to a show in Chicago and you see that Goose Island sign, you know you're in good hands. They're music fans as well as great beer makers at Goose Island, so we're really proud to be associated with them.
The Goose Island Beer Company, Chicago's beer.
Sound Opinions is supported by Goose Island. Since 1988, Goose Island's been brewing beers in the spirit of Chicago.
You can find IPAs, Lemonade Shandy, and limited releases in-store or at one of Goose's venues in Chicago. Goose Island Beer Company, Chicago's beer.
She was a rare thing, fine as a bee's wing. So fine that I might crush her when she lay. She was a lost child, she was running wild. She said, as long as there's no price on love, I'll stay. And you wouldn't want me any other way.
Welcome back to Sound Opinions. I'm Jim DeRogatis. Him over there, he's Greg Kot. That is a little bit of the song Bee's Wing by our guest this week, Richard Thompson, returning to Sound Opinions. He was, of course, a key member in the British folk rock revival of the 60s with his group, Fairport Convention, and he's been a talented solo artist for many years after that, with some incredible 20 studio albums to his name. And to all those accomplishments, Greg, we can now add engaging author.
No doubt, Jim. He turns out to be a great writer in addition to being a great songwriter. Earlier this year, he released his memoir, Bee's Wing, Losing My Way and Finding My Voice.
Greg, it's a good day at Sound Opinions when we have a guest we're as excited about as Richard Thompson. Although, Richard, it is not quite as good a day as the last time you were on our show when you sat with us with your guitar. Mm. And back when we could all be in a room, it was wonderful. Remember those days?
Those were the days.
Remember those days?
I do, fondly.
But we have Richard Thompson on the show to talk about, not a new album, Greg, a new book, Bee's Wing. It is a fascinating book. It is very much like sitting with you and hearing the stories of the early days of Fairport Convention and how you came to love and discover music. You're covering 67 to 75, but there's a, you know, a little bit before that, too. Why don't we start at the beginning? I just fell in love. I was laughing and also kind of a tear in my eye about your first guitars. You were eager to get your hand on one of these instruments, and you kept getting these toy cowboy tin guitars early on that you would instantly destroy.
Well, I think that they were built to be destroyed, basically. You know, they were literally toys that my parents would continue to fob me off with, thinking I wasn't really serious. But I was serious. I was absolutely serious. Finally, you know, a guitar turned up in the house when I was about 10 years old that I think my father thought he was going to play. And then my sister thought she was going to play it. But I knew it was my destiny to get my hands on that guitar. So I did. I commandeered it. And that set me off on the road.
I love that you're very self-deprecating in the book. I would love to have been in the room when that music teacher called you a musical no-hoper. was there ever like a comeuppance moment where you got some communication with that person years later and said, well, by the way, I did okay despite your low opinion of my musical abilities?
There was no comeuppance. As life is often kind enough to one that you get away with things, you know, and things disappear into the rearview mirror and become basically forgotten until you start writing a book about it.
And then it all comes
back.
But
you weren't discouraged by the fact that...
I think more encouraged, strangely enough. I think it kind of, I think it pushes you rather than stops you. It depends the kind of person you are. I refuse to be stopped.
Yeah. I'll show them. I'll show him.
I'll show them.
You came up in the 60s, as a, you know, we mentioned, and you know, the book starts in 67. You're around 20 years old at the time, right? Whatever, a little younger.
I'm 18. 18. I'm 18 in 67.
Teenager. Yeah. And you had to be one of the few guitarists in London that wasn't completely smitten with Chicago blues and wanted to imitate Buddy Guy or any of the great blues guitarists, Otis Rush. You were doing your own thing. And I just wondered how, to me, that has held up very well. That was a very smart decision. You were very distinctive, and to this day, you still are. But back then, everybody else around you was doing this thing, and you were the guy that seemed to be not doing it. How did you manage to resist that?
It was a crowded field. There were so many British blues guitar players. There's the famous ones. There was Eric and Jeff Beck and Jimmy Page and Mick Taylor and all those, you know, and Peter Green. But there were also local ones. I mean, just down the street there were, you know, local guitar legends, you know, hammering out the blues. And I thought, you know, is this what I want to do? You know, do I want to be yet another blues guitar player from Britain? I always felt, you know, slightly secondhand anyway. I wasn't growing up in Chicago. You know, everything was learned off a record. Mm-hmm. You know, when Hendrix turned up in London, he was a guy who could really, really play the blues extremely well. And he was like the real thing. And I think the other guitar players at that point had to look at each other and say, oh, gosh, this is something, you know, authentic. This is learned from the source rather than from a record. So, you know, I think from about the age of... you know, 16 onwards, I thought I want to be something a bit different. So I started to listen to classical music. I started to listen to jazz. And I started to hang out in folk clubs, listen to folk music.
Yeah.
And in whatever year it was, 69, Fairport made this big decision to make this album of British traditional music played with amplified instruments and drums. And that was a kind of watershed, really, for us. And in many ways, we didn't look back after that.
Who knows where the time goes?
that was a brave decision in a lot of ways, Richard, at a point where everything was about the future, the present and the future, you know, a psychedelic moment, and we're all moving to brave new uncharted lands, journeying toward the white light. You were, and your mates in Fairport were looking at music that was centuries old, you know, and saying, how does this relate to us now? As a result, I think, whereas some records from that era sound very dated, you know, there was a timelessness to the Fairport recordings then that remains now. But you were looking back instead of forward, like so many of your peers.
Well, sometimes you do look back to go forwards. We were thinking that this was probably the most groundbreaking thing that we could do. You know, when I was at school, I was really into art theory. I was really into John Cage. I was into, you know, modern classical music like Stockhausen, Ligeti, all this kind of very dissonant abstract stuff. And at the point that Fairport made this decision, I thought this is the most revolutionary thing that we could do at this time. This is more revolutionary than Roxy music, you know, being, I think, having a sort of tongue-in-cheek take on popular music. You know, it's more revolutionary than the Velvet Underground. It's more revolutionary than David Bowie. We really thought this was the most groundbreaking thing that we could do.
Yeah. You know, when I think about the folk movement in America, you know, people point back to like the Holy Grail was the Harry Smith folk anthology. Like everybody was of a certain age was listening to that record and saying, wow, there's great stuff here to mine, including Dylan. But what was the equivalent of that in England? Was there something like that, that, you know, you and Shirley Collins and Ann Briggs and Sandy Denny, there was a small pocket of people that seemed to be really into this stuff. What was it?
It was more... really trying to find those songs at the source. It was a dangerous time for folk music because certainly in parts of England, it was almost gone, obliterated by, you know, I think after World War II, as the agricultural life became more rarefied, more people moved to the towns, there was a real danger that all these old songs were going to disappear. So people like Shirley Collins would go out collecting songs. They go visiting local singers and they write the songs down or they tape record them. And this was another revival. There'd been a big folk music revival at the turn of the last century, in 1900, where people like Cecil Sharp went out collecting songs for the same reason, because he thought the songs and dance of England were in danger of disappearing. So Shirley was doing the same kind of thing. People like Ewan McColl, A.L. Lloyd were all trying to revive this music, keep it alive. And really, you know, the folk rockers like Fairport were kind of piggybacking on top of that movement just a decade later. We relied a lot on the few recordings that there were, and we relied on written sources sometimes for songs. A song like Sir Patrick Spens that Fairport covered, well, we didn't really know what the tune was. It's such an old song that it's so rarely actually sung that we kind of used a tune from another song to sing that. So we had the text and we had to figure out a way to revive it and make it into something singable.
The king sits in Dunfermline town, drinking of the blood red wine.
Where can I get a steaming skipper to sail this mighty boat of mine?
And how did you integrate? I mean, I think the great innovation was Simon Nicol once said, you know, we're going to electrocute these songs. Bringing the electric guitar into that vocabulary of these traditional instruments. I mean, that to me is the real trick. How do you do that? I mean, was that something that was very organic for you? Like it made sense from the start? Or did you have to really work to figure out a way that those instruments were going to blend?
We had to think about it, and some songs worked and some songs didn't work, which we found out very quickly, in fact. As an electric guitar player, you know, I was thinking, well, I need to be more like a fiddle. I need to be more like a melodeon or an accordion. I need to be playing more single notes and playing unison with the fiddle sometimes. We're trying to think, well, don't just think chordally about this song. Think about it as a drone. Think about it as something that exists in more than one key at once, which a lot of folk music does. So sometimes it's hard to define if a song is in E or A or D. in a sense, it's in all keys at the same time. So you had to kind of had that in the background when you were working on songs.
Those three albums, I mean, what a year 69 was, right? What we did on our holidays, Unhalf Breaking and Leash and Leave, were just these groundbreaking records with Sandy Denny, and then you fired her at the end of the year, which I think is one of the revelations of the book. I hope I'm not, you know, speaking out of turn here, but I mean, it was...
Spoiler alert!
It's
You're
quite,
giving it all away. You're giving it all away.
Quite a revelation.
Well, I mean, we fired her, but she was kind of gone anyway. That was how we felt, you know, really, that she wasn't likely to stick around much longer the way things were going. Also, you know, but remember that we had just had this accident where we lost our drummer.
Yeah.
And we were still, at that point, you know, shell-shocked, really. We were still suffering from really PTSD, I suppose, and we weren't thinking straight. Had we been in a better frame of mind, I'm sure Sandy would have stayed in the band, and who knows what the history would have been in a different universe like that. But as it was a parting of the ways, and it was kind of tragic in retrospect. But it's what happened, and Sandy went on to form a great band. Ashley went on to form a couple of great bands. So in some ways, perhaps that gave them the freedom to do what they wanted to do.
Mm-hmm.
Richard, I want to ask you about the bus crash in 1969. It severely injured you and several other band members, and it killed Fairport drummer Martin Lamble and your girlfriend at the time, Jeannie Franklin. What a thing to go through at such a young age and so early in the career of the band. Many groups would never have recovered.
I think we took a long time thinking about whether it was worth the price of that kind of tragedy.
You said you would break down in tears at times when you were writing that section.
Yeah, it was very difficult to write. It was harder to read the audiobook, which I just did. That was really tough. I really had to pretend this is about somebody else. Mm-hmm. I'm just telling a story. I can get through this, but I had to stop frequently. It's tough. Still traumatic to this day. And yeah, you know, I talk sometimes to the other survivors, to Simon Nicol and Ashley Hutchings, and we all feel the same. It was such a tragic thing to happen that it touches us today, and we don't forget those people.
Yeah.
You know, they're in our thoughts all the time.
Yeah.
After the break, we'll continue our conversation with Richard Thompson and discuss the work he did with his ex-wife and music partner, Linda Thompson, and how he has avoided musical burnout over his long career. That's next on Sound Opinions.
Remember in 2018 when Border Patrol separated thousands of refugee kids from their parents, deported those parents back to their home countries, and kept the kids in the United States? Believe it or not, 6 years later, there are still hundreds of families who have not yet been reunited.
Though we as a community may feel hopeless at times, we recently learned about an organization called Al Otro Lado, which works to reunify families. They provide holistic legal and humanitarian support to refugees, deportees, and other migrants in the U.S. and Tijuana through a multidisciplinary, client-centered, harm reduction-based practice.
Since 2018, they've reunited over 100 refugee families ripped apart by the zero-tolerance policy of the previous administration. Once reunited, Al Otro Lado helps each family find legal representation, housing, and the counseling they need in order to heal and get back on their feet.
Imagine having your child ripped from your arms and never knowing when you would see them again. We can't let family separations go on. If you're like us and believe that all families belong together, then join us supporting Al Otro Lado and donate today.
You can find the link to donate to Al Otro Lado in the description of this episode, or go to gum.fm/charity and donate today. That's gum.fm /charity.
You can also consider volunteering with the organization, which offers opportunities that are both in-person and virtual. The best way to get involved is by filling out an application on their website, elotrolado.org/volunteer.
Delve into the shadows of the mind with Sleeping Dogs, a gripping murder mystery starring Academy Award winner Russell Crowe. Now available on digital. Crowe portrays an ex-homicide detective unraveling a brutal murder he can't recall. Uncovering secrets from his past, he learns a chilling truth. It's best to let sleeping dogs lie. Visit sleepingdogsmovie.com/Wondery to watch Sleeping Dogs, now on digital. That's sleepingdogsmovie.com/Wondery.
And we're back. This week, we're talking with Richard Thompson about his career and memoir. Let's jump back into the conversation.
I'm always fascinated by that psychedelic moment in the UK, in the US. You wind up with a very fruitful partnership with Joe Boyd. He, you know, produced the Pink Floyd records, right? The earliest ones, you know. I'm wondering how the psychedelic consciousness affected the music of Fairport. Because it was, some people could say, oh, they're playing ancient folk songs, it's traditional music. But there was an awareness there. You said one of the key words earlier, the drones that made those old folk songs work. There was a psychedelic awareness, I've always thought, to many of those Fairport records.
Well, if you think a song like A Sailor's Life on the Unhearthbreaking record, which was Fairport's, you know, first real foray into traditional music, that's the point where we really successfully blended the two musical styles. Mm-hmm. And, there's a real jam on that song that wouldn't be out of place in a psychedelic club in London, you know, in 1967, 68, 69.
Oh, no, fair maid.
That was absolutely, you know, the milieu for that kind of music. I've seen other people describe it as being like a rag, like an Indian rag, the way it's constructed. And again, that wasn't really in our thoughts. Well, we weren't really thinking in those terms. We just thought, this is something that we do anyway. We do these long instrumental passages, not that different from, you know, so some of the other bands around the London scene. The Floyd would do long instrumental passages. Yeah. It was okay with the audience. The audience permitted it.
Yeah.
And so we kind of did it as well. So for us to play a song that was 10 minutes long was nothing unusual. In a different age, if Fairport had emerged in 77 instead of 67, when it was all 3-minute punk songs, it might have been a very different kind of blending of traditional and electric.
Mm. Yeah. I adored the band for so many years, Richard, and I went back to that 1970. I've got bootlegs galore from that 1970 American tour. And one thing that struck me in the book, it just kind of highlighted that something we all kind of knew, but you were like the first so-called British invasion band not to be recycling the music that Americans had previously heard for their gratification, you know. It was really a daring approach, and I get the sense that the reception was not, people weren't buying in, or they were still having trouble like understanding what was going on here. I mean, I don't want to mischaracterize that, but what was your sense of the American audience in 1970 to what Fairport was doing?
I think slightly bemused, a bit of head scratching going on. I think we go down politely without being, you know, extremely welcomed. I'm thinking about the Fillmores, you know, just kind of like a stoned response, nothing too special. People not really that engaged. People were waiting for Jethro Tull or Traffic to come on next, you know, really. The breakthrough for us was the Philadelphia Folk Festival, where we absolutely stormed it. I mean, I don't think they'd seen anything quite like it, and we hadn't really seen anything like it outside of Britain. where, you know, the entire audience of 10,000 people were up and dancing. I mean, everybody was dancing.
Mm-hmm.
And they actually gave us an encore, which was not really in the folk tradition. You know, you're supposed to be, you know, a bit more socialist and nothing too special. So, you know, encores are a bit bourgeois, but yeah. They had to give us an encore. They absolutely had to give us an encore. So that was a real breakthrough. I think we found our audience among the folk fans rather than the rock fans. Interestingly, I think the African Americans in the audience kind of dug what we were doing more than the white audience, which is very bizarre. But yeah. When you think about it, not so strange. I think they recognized that we were not recycling their music.
Yeah. Yeah. The blues is the music of their ancestors. You're playing the music of your ancestors.
Yeah, exactly. And I think that they appreciated that. You
know? Yeah, that's interesting.
You don't advertise yourself a lot. You say that, which is why it was kind of a surprise for those of us who followed your career to know that this book was coming, Bee's Wing. And it ends with the making of Shoot Out the Lights with your first wife, Linda, but not the tour, which a lot of people are grousing about. It is famously a difficult tour for both of you. But I saw something great online. I believe The Guardian emailed Linda and said, what do you think about Richard writing a book? And she said she was never worried. He's not one of these people that, you know, throws out all the dirt. She said she was eager to read it. I'm dying to know if it's if he's as good a book writer as he is a songwriter. I think that's incredibly generous and a cool thing for an ex. I mean, she knew she was going to be in there.
Yeah, she's in there. I mean, the book truly stops in 1975. Mm-hmm. And everything after that is an afterword, really. Yeah. I'm just tying loose ends for people, really. But yeah. it does take a chapter or two to tie those loose ends. So I don't say anything about, you know, 76 to 81 particularly, because I think we made bad records and there's nothing I want to write about in that period. So, mm-hmm. So I mentioned 81, I mentioned, our marriage breaking up. And really, I'm just catching up to that point. You know, Volume 6 will deal with the 81 tour, yeah. If we get there.
Let me write on the wall of bed one more time. We can waste your time on the other rides. This is the nearest to being alive. Oh, let me take my chances on.
Well, I mean, the music you made with her is extraordinary, and I think one of the things that was eye-opening for me was that period between you'd quit Fairport, you were a session musician, you know, you'd known Linda, but then you were starting to tour together in the folk clubs.
Mm-hmm.
And the folk clubs in that sort of very intimate environment, sometimes not even mic'd up, you said that's kind of where you found your voice, right? As a vocalist, at least, right?
Yeah. Well, you know, folk clubs are in many ways a wonderful British institution. They have a kind of a formula where anybody can get up and sing by prior arrangement with the organizer. So it's a first place to sing in public for a lot of people. It's a place for people who are further down the road to establish a repertoire and mm-hmm. establish an audience. And it's a living for a whole range of acoustic musicians. There's a whole tour circuit. It still exists, really, but it was much bigger in the 60s and 70s. They're usually, you know, the upstairs room of a pub. They're kind of the entertainment room in a pub. They might hold 50 people. They might hold 100. And mm-hmm. sometimes there's hardly a stage. Sometimes there's hardly a PA. So you just get up and you sing. Anything shy about you or arrogant about you or in other ways kind of defective about your personality, it's going to be found out very, very quickly by the audience, because they're standing like a foot from your face, that they are absolutely right there. So you better be honest, sincere about your music and unpretentious about your music, and, and just get up there and belt it out as best you can.
Simple, simple and plain is plain. If you leave me now, you won't come back again when the game is up. I don't really gonna love.
Well, it's interesting. I talked to Linda years ago. And she said, even in the best days of our marriage, you guys didn't really communicate that well. But I think that the reason the music was good is that we tended to save it for the work. And she was specifically referencing the Shoot Out the Lights record, but I think she was talking about in general the way you collaborated. I mean, what's your take on what she said?
Well, I think we did have a good working relationship. I think we both loved, you know, songwriting. We loved the song process. And I think we loved rehearsing. I think we loved developing songs. But probably emotionally, as human beings, we could have communicated a lot better. But we were young, you know, and we got married at 23, which seems young to me now. And you know, at that age, you bring a lot of baggage with you. So you have to really work with each other to stay married, to develop into a proper relationship. And in some ways, we did that. In some ways, we didn't.
Mm-hmm. The love of songwriting does come through. And the book includes an appendix of some of the lyrics of the songs that you reference throughout the book. So that made me wonder, why choose for the title of your first memoir, maybe first of several, who knows, but maybe the last, Beeswing. Why Beeswing?
Well, I think that's a song that looks back to the 60s and 70s. I mean, I wrote it, when did I write it? Probably the 90s. But it seems to look back, and for me, it encapsulates some of the spirit of that decade. Mm-hmm. When a lot of people that I knew did not take the path well traveled, they dropped out of school, they dropped out of university, they became hippies, you know, they lived on communes, you know, they became drug dealers in some cases, but they definitely did not want to follow their parents' way of life.
I was 19 when I came to town. They called it the summer of love. They were burning babies, burning flags, the hawks against the doves.
And for me, you know, the 60s was a big watershed, really, in terms of generations. In the UK, you know, Monty Python was almost like the final nail in the coffin of the establishment, where you could make fun then of anybody. You know, you didn't have to hold back at the Queen. You didn't have to hold back at judges. You didn't have to hold back at the police or politicians. You could actually lampoon anybody. And that was very refreshing. And that was almost, you know, dragging Britain forwards into the 20th century in some ways. You know, Britain had been held back in Victorian Britain for so long. You know, really the model was from about, you know, 1890, that we were still living in the 50s. So when the 60s came, it was like this breath of fresh air for the younger generation. And suddenly in the 60s, you had all this youth culture. You had, you know, David Bailey and Twiggy and, you know, the Avengers TV series. And you had Richard Hamilton and Peter Blake doing pop art and the Beatles, you know, and then the Stones and, the whole musical door opened. And to be in London at that time was extraordinary. Even though Fairport weren't the first generation, but we were kind of the next musical generation after the Stones and the Kinks, you know, and the Yardbirds. So we were kind of 5 years down the road. But we're still at the center of everything, at the center of world culture in many ways. So that was a fantastic experience to be alive at that time.
Mm-hmm. Well, the one thing that I can say about you in comparison to a lot of your peers from that era is that you're still making really good records consistently. Mm. I realize that doesn't put you in the greatest position to answer that question about, you know, assess why that is. But why is that, Richard?
Why is that? I don't know. I think it's a combination of things. Musical curiosity means I want to see what's around the next bend. So I want to write that next song and see where that takes me. I want to write something that no one's written before. Mm-hmm. So that kind of drives me forward. Or if I'm not writing songs, maybe I want to write, you know, a musical play or something. I want to do something that pushes me forward. So I'm kind of pulling myself forward, but at the same time, I'm driven by, I think, demons. You know, I think demons from the past kind of drive me onwards. It's the Charlie Parker thing, you know. And if I got psychoanalyzed, maybe I'd stop making music altogether, because then I'd be sane and normal and happy.
You run me like flies on a birthday cake. How did I get to figure you so wrong? If I touch you now, I might get a frostbite. We'd go from so warm to so long.
Do you think, Richard, to some extent, I don't mean this to sound insulting, you've never been popular enough to burn out, right? You're the consummate cult artist, you know? You don't have the dilemma of, are we going to do 60 arenas on this tour or just 45?
Well, that's a luxury I could handle, actually. I think I can manage that.
But how about the dilemma of like playing the same 15 songs every night, because, you know, 60,000 people expect to hear your greatest hits and they don't want to know about the new stuff that you're doing?
Yeah, that could possibly get very boring, actually, couldn't it?
You do hear Keith Richards grouse about it. You know, you just know when in his honest moments he'll say, I never have to play Brown Sugar again.
Yeah, that must be frustrating and... going through the motions in many ways. But having said that, I've got songs that I play most nights, and I've played them maybe for 30 years, and I still find something in them. If the song's good enough, you can reinterpret it forever. Forever.
See, I knew that. Yeah. Richard Thompson's been waiting to sell out his whole career. That paragraph where he writes about the first trip to America and the record company sent the two stretch limos.
Yeah.
And is only disillusioned later, 6 months later, when he finds out that they went on his budget.
Right.
But there was something there, Richard, and ooh, I'm in a stretch limo.
Well, yeah, it was impressive for a minute. Yeah.
Yeah. Right.
Well, we loved it. Well, we just thought, well, we'd arrived. You know, we thought this is great. Gosh, you know, what nice people they are at the record company.
When they invite you out to dinner and then you find out they've billed it to you later.
Yeah,
right?
Yeah, it's classic. It's classic stuff. Absolutely classic.
It's encouraging to know that the same kid at 17 who said, you know, I don't want to do that Chicago blues thing because everybody else is doing it, is still the same guy. It sounds like you're still, everybody's going right, I'm going left.
Well, you know, I always wanted to be different. I always wanted to be a musical pioneer, in whatever that meant, you know, in whatever field. And in Ashley and Simon, I found people that were kind of like-minded. You know, we all wanted to be different. You know, we're very idealistic about music and thought a lot about the kind of music we wanted to play. So in some ways, you know, Fairport's approach was never an accident. I think we fell into some wonderful situations. You know, being part of the psychedelic scene propelled us forwards, which was something that was beyond our control. But certainly we were very thoughtful about the musical style. And I think that has stood us in good stead over the years.
Well, we have been talking to the one and only Henry the Human Fly, a.k.a. Richard Thompson, author. I think Linda's question has been answered. You are as good a songwriter as you are a book writer.
I think she was satisfied.
Well, sorry, I'm blushing.
Well, hey, we've written some books. We know how hard it is. Not nearly as much fun as gigging with the band, but you couldn't gig.
That's true.
You've been stuck at home for a while. Yep. Thank you, Richard, for being on Sound Opinions a second time.
Thank you so much.
That wraps up our splendid chat with Richard Thompson, and now we want to hear from you. Do you have a favorite song of his, or Fairport Convention, or Richard and Linda? Leave us a message on our website, soundopinions.org. Also, stay tuned for our upcoming bonus podcast with some great outtakes from our interview with Richard. Greg, what do we have on the show next week?
Next week, Jim, we've got an in-depth conversation with Yola, who just put out one of the year's best albums in both of our opinions.
Yeah.
And for our bonus podcast, I took a trip to the desert island to pay tribute to Dusty Hill, the great bassist of ZZ Top, whom we just lost, and play a song from him that I cannot live without.
A worthy topic, Greg. To take our Sound Opinions survey, you've only got one more week. Go to soundopinions.org. The link will be on our homepage. For more Sound Opinions, listen to our podcast wherever you find such things. The views, thoughts, and opinions expressed in this program belong solely to Sound Opinions and not necessarily to Columbia College Chicago or our sponsors.
And speaking of sponsors, every week our show reaches hundreds of thousands of curious listeners from around the globe via podcast, and on 150 public radio stations nationwide. If you'd like to learn more on how your business or organization can also reach this engaged and educated audience, you can email sponsor at soundopinions.org. That's sponsor at soundopinions.org.
Thanks, as always, to our Patreon supporters. Sound Opinions is produced by Andrew Gill, Alex Claiborne, our intern, Sol Delgadillo, and we get social media help from Katie Cotton.